Hello, welcome to Repast, a food law and policy podcast from the Resnick Center for Food Law and Policy at UCLA Law. I'm Michael Roberts, the Executive Director of the Resnick Center.
And I'm Diana Winters, the Assistant Director of the Center. The Resnick Center performs cutting-edge legal research and scholarship in food law and policy to improve health and quality of life for humans and the planet.
Each month, we'll bring you an interview with thought leaders transforming food law and policy.
Hello, and welcome to Repast. My name is Diana Winters, the Deputy Director of the Resnick Center for Food Law and Policy at UCLA Law. My co-host, Michael Roberts, will not be co-hosting today because in this very special episode of Repast, he is our guest. We're going to talk about his new publication, co-written with the Law Service at the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, which is called The International and National Regulatory Strategies to Counter Food Fraud. And we will put a link to that in our show notes. We're so happy to have you today, Michael.
Thank you. Good to be here in this different role.
As many of you know, Professor Roberts is the founding executive director of the Resnick Center. He taught the first food law and policy course in the United States in 2004, and he served as the leading force in the development of the first scholarly journal devoted exclusively to the field. That's the Journal of Food Law and Policy, which was founded in 2005. Since he came to UCLA in 2013, Professor Roberts has authored and edited many books and articles and chapters on food law, including some of the major foundational publications on food law, the first major treatise on food law, which is titled Food Law in the United States, and the case book, Food Law, Cases and Materials, which, again, I guess many of you have most likely used in your classes. And he's currently editing the research handbook on international food law, which should be published later this year or next year. Roberts is also actively engaged in the global development of food law and policy. He's lectured on food law subjects at law schools, workshops, conferences in many countries, including the US, China, Korea, the UK, Italy, Belgium, Canada, Spain, Romania, Turkey, and Russia. He recently led the Resnick Center into a partnership with the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization on a series of research and advisory initiatives to confront global food security and quality and nutrition and safety. Phew, that's a lot. I'm surprised we've waited this long to feature you, but I am glad we are doing it now.
That's very nice. Thank you. I'm feeling tired just listening to that. But of course, I've been surrounded by really good people such as yourself and others as well.
Well, we are glad to have you in food law. So today we're going to talk about your new publication on food fraud, which was co-authored with the legal department of the FAO. How did you come to write this?
Well, and this again was born out of the partnership that we have with the FAO, with the Development Legal Office. And it was their suggestion, based on some of the work that we had done previously, as well as the work that was at that time being done by the Codex Alimentarius Commission by a committee, and some of the other conversations that were circulating around different countries on this sort of emerging issue, although it's not really an emerging issue, but it's certainly catching the attention of countries, including developing countries. So that's what I came to write it with them, and I really appreciate our friends at FAO, a terrific team. They were great to work with, and there were lots of hands that were engaged in this report, from including yourself and others at FAO who engaged in the editing process and giving comments and assessing. So it was truly a team effort, and I appreciate very much their confidence in us, as well as their incredible expertise and hard work. So it was a team effort.
And I know you just said that it is not an emerging issue, but it is rising to the forefront of consciousness. But what brought you to food fraud as a topic of research and scholarship?
Well, before I even got into food law, I was in full-time practice at my law firm, and one of my last cases was a really interesting case involving art fraud of sculptures, statues that were being imported from Asia that were knockoffs from original pieces of really nice art and expensive art. And so that led to hearings and litigation and eventually a settlement. And in fact, I lived in the Rockefeller Center in New York City for a winter as we engaged in this case. And so it really got my interest going. In fact, I thought for a time that art fraud would be a really interesting pathway for me as a lawyer. But I was drawn to food, and I kept that commitment and ended up leaving the firm to start in food law and agricultural law at the time. And so when I first came across this issue of food fraud, it really got my interest because of my experience with art fraud in this one case that I had. And so I began to look into it, and it was fascinating to me on so many different levels because it was... If you're interested in the history of food law, you start with fraud because you go all the way back to the Roman Empire, even in Greece and earlier times, even in Asia, not just Europe or in the West, you will find examples of food fraud and how governments dealt with it. And so it's a really, really old problem. Secondly, it's incredibly complicated because it signifies a robust trade system. Usually fraud occurs with imported food product. And so it's complicated, and it sort of tells us what kind of a food system we live in. And then third, it was, to me, it has all the different intersections that we see in food law. For example, between law and science, between food industry and consumers. And again, consumers always end up on the short end, and they certainly have in food fraud. And so, and then it has this sort of newness attached to it, where it truly is a modern problem as well, even though it's been around for a long time, because it reflects this changing modern food system that we live in. And just also principles of fairness and right. And it has a real sort of moral underpinning that drives us all crazy for those of us that are trying to figure out solutions to the problem.
Talking about fairness, and when we talk about food fraud, I have heard you talk about this before, but food fraud, when you talk about consumers being on the short end of the stick, it can affect health, but it also affects fairness and economics. Is that correct? How does it hurt consumers?
Yeah. And before I answer that question, I should also add that the part that really appealed to me as well is that there is an important role for law. And that's the piece that we keep searching for. Science alone is not going to solve food fraud. In some ways, it exasperates because the cheaters are pretty smart and they become more sophisticated when you come up with a solution. But in terms of consumer impact, yeah, consumers, well, they don't get the benefit of their bargain, for one. You know, when you buy something and thinking it is something marked as A, and it ends up being diluted A or substituted A by some other letter that is not as appealing to you, you don't get the benefit of your bargain, so you're cheated. Secondly, consumers oftentimes can suffer problems of health. So for example, if there's some ingredient is substituted with another that could create an allergen problem, that's a health issue, health risk. Other times, such as the melamine situation in China involving pet food and infant formula, it can lead to death and hospitalization and severe safety issues. So, and then finally, third, I think just the trust. I mean, consumers want to trust the food system. They want to trust that when they go into store and they buy a jar of honey, that it's really honey and not some diluted form of honey, or it's really, you know, premium olive oil. It's something that affects consumers and their outlook on food and their perceptions of food, as well as their health and safety.
That makes sense. You mentioned the melamine scandal, and how did food fraud start to come to common awareness today? As you said, it's an old problem, but why are we thinking about it now?
Yeah, there was an event, I think it was in 2008, 2009, if my memory serves me correct, where in China, Well, first of all, what happened was that we noticed that pets were dying all over the world. Canada particularly was hit, the U.S. and other countries. And it was traced back quickly to melamine that was being added to pet food in order to increase the weight and increase the gain, the dollar amount that the manufacturers were receiving. And so, but it was deadly and it killed pets. And then as we looked into the scandal a little bit more, we discovered that it was also added to infant formula, led to the deaths of 6 Chinese babies in China, as well as the hospitalization of thousands of infants. And so it was this huge explosion in the media about it. I remember I was practicing law at the time in Washington, D.C., and a reporter called me and said, well, why don't we just shut down trade with China altogether with food? You know, that's the sort of simplistic thinking but it was important that signified the time, but it was important because people really didn't understand how the food system worked. Not that we do now, but I think we're a little bit more sophisticated now. And unfortunately, it was events like this that has helped contribute to that growing sophistication. But it caught everyone's attention, and it led to an FDA hearing, a public hearing. And the FDA, this is the first time the FDA had looked at what it called economically motivated adulteration, which is another way to frame food fraud, focusing on the adulteration, the fact that it's motivated by economic gain. And so there was this hearing in Washington, D.C., and it was interesting because not very many people attended the hearing. And I remember being in a conference shortly after that hearing with someone from the FDA legal team, and I asked the audience, you know, why didn't you show up at the hearing? And one brave soul, I remember still, a food scientist from a company that I won't name, raised his hand and he said, well, it's because the lawyers told us not to go. In other words, what we don't know won't hurt us. And so, and I think at that time, that seemed to be the concern, is we don't want to go to a hearing and make this a confessional and expose ourselves to liability. And because we don't, and I think the bottom line is that companies really didn't know where their food was coming from at that time. And so the lack of traceability and the lack of technology to help companies understand and monitor and so forth. We've moved a long way since then. And I think most food companies are concerned about supply chain fraud with food, but still how to solve it is we're still quite a ways away from it. But that's how it kind of got on the radar. And it sparked a lot of interest. And there's been a lot of media events since then. And we understand better today than we did now about how extensive the fraud is.
That's really interesting. It makes me think about the turn of the 19th century. And weren't some of the first United States laws about food, like the Pure Food and Drug Act in 1906, passed partly in response to the contamination of milk that was hurting and killing infants because milk was being filled with other substances?
Yeah, there's a lot of reports about swirl milk at that time in New York City, for example, that led to the death of infants. And then, of course, the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act, you know, was influenced heavily by The Jungle, by Upton Sinclair, which caught the attention of President Roosevelt and others in Congress, and groups like Good Housekeeping Magazine, which were led by essentially, not to use a pejorative term, but at that time, it was used then, housewives who were interested in food safety and food quality. And so there was this movement afoot to implement some sort of federal legislation. That's what led to the first federal food act. And so, yeah, food fraud was a part of it, and it was integrally linked to food safety. So it's been around. I mean, we look at China, for example, and think, well, this is where all the problems of food fraud rest, forgetting the fact that we've had ourselves over 100 years to work on this problem since the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act. So these problems are not easily solved, but they do reflect sort of an industrialization of food as well as a greater food trade as well.
Have you seen in your work and tracking these problems, has the problem gotten worse since the pandemic, since we've all heard about supply chain hiccups and problems and stoppages? that has there been a rise in food fraud?
There certainly was an anticipation that there would be at the beginning of COVID. And I think I've read some initial reports that documented that it seemed to be on the uptick, that there was an increase. I haven't read anything recently that substantiates that, but it stands to reason that it would. And I think that because the problem, again, we have to be careful not to say that the problem was created by COVID, but it was certainly exacerbated. So I think it has gotten presumably a little bit worse, but even if it didn't, it's still bad enough to certainly try to figure out a way to stop it.
That makes sense. And so you've said today and in the report, you talk about how the problem is very complicated and in some ways intractable. Can you explain this to our audience? Why is it so complicated?
Well, some of it's historical accident and some of it is just the complexities of the problem. By historical accident, what I mean by that, and I don't mean to overstate this, but we have a regulatory regime that is, again, set up to restrict or to forbid adulteration of food as well as mislabeling of food. And food fraud or economically motivated adulteration is a part of adulteration. But as it so happens, government, not just in the United States, but worldwide, they only have so many resources. And most of this food, again, is imported that's subject to economic motivated adulteration. And we only inspect, you know, less than 2% of food anyway. And so trying to figure out to catch it is a challenge. And then when you're dealing, so the ability to even scope out the problem is a problem. We know there's a lot of food fraud, but we're not even quite sure we know where it all is and what it looks like. And we find it, when we find it, then we all holler about it. We pay attention to it, but we're all assuming, and I think the assumption is pretty safe, that there's a lot under the iceberg that we're not seeing that's coming in. So detection certainly is a problem. But I think it's also the fact that if there's a safety issue with food fraud, then it gets immediate attention. So the culture of around government regulation has evolved to the point where that seems to be the first question that's asked when you present it, when a government is presented with a food fraud problem, is there a safety problem attached to it? If there is, then you get immediate action. If there isn't, then you don't get a reaction as nearly as quickly as you do if there's safety issues. So and that's what I mean by historical accidents. We've relegated food fraud as a kind of a second tier adulteration problem. Now, I have said that to government officials before, and they get really angry with me because they don't like to hear that. But in essence, that's the reality. And so if one is out there representing a food, you know, a group of producers, for example, who are being harmed by this type of adulteration or consumers, one has to realize that it's difficult to get the government's attention.
That makes sense. What are some of the existing regulatory tools we have that we're trying to address these problems with, even with all of these complexities?
Well, the tools that we have today are generally, and it depends on, again, this is a global report. So, you know, it varies from country to country, obviously. But in the U.S., which is where I'll do most of my focus here, it's done through inspection, I suppose. I don't really know of too many cases that have emerged from government inspecting food and finding there's a fraud issue without having any kind of tip in advance that there is a fraud problem. Usually it happens when somebody makes a complaint. And generally speaking, the consumers don't know there's a problem to complain about because they're on the receiving end and they're the ones being defrauded. So what happens usually, it's a competitor or somebody, a manufacturer who has clean hands, somebody who's not participating in the fraud, and they notice that someone else is making a lot of money and they're committing fraud, and they tip the FDA off, and there's then either an investigation or, and usually you have to complain about it more than once. And so you continue to complain about it, and eventually somebody looks at it. That's usually what happens. Then the problem is, what do you do then? so that there's a, say that honey or olive oil or tomato sauce or, you know, a particular kind of fish or whatever it is the subject of this fraud. What do? You have to test it. So who's going to test it? Oftentimes the food companies who are complaining about it will do their own test. And then you have to find a laboratory that's able to test. And that's not easy to do. Because what do you have to test it against? You have to have some sort of standard. And so a standard is like a recipe, and it's something that's adopted by the FDA or by the, in some cases, other agencies that will measure whether a food product is authentic. And these standards become outdated. The FDA is not in the business of making standards anymore. And that presents a problem in and of itself. So it's hard to prove. And then once you get through all of that, then there's the question of enforcement. How do you enforce? And who does the enforcing? And this is where law, you know, needs to play a role. So, for example, if I have a honey sample and I'm worried I'm in the food chain. I may be a retailer. I could be, you know, in the distribution side of it. I could be a broker. I could be whoever. I send it to a laboratory and they test the honey. Let's say that it tests positive for fraud. What happens to the honey? Is the lab required to destroy the honey? Are they required to tell the government? Depends on where the lab is. Most likely the answer is no. So that what happens to that honey? The chances are, not all the time, but the chances are that honey could be reintroduced back into the food system, back into the stream of commerce, and just mixed and with another, by somebody else with another product line. So it's we need laws that actually help identify, assess, and help, you know, test and then also enforce. And so it's a complicated system, and there isn't a lot of accountability.
I know this is too big for you to get into too much, but what about internationally? Where do the regulatory tools addressing food fraud sit internationally?
Well, that's the problem as well, just because there is no international body that has enforcement authority. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations doesn't have authority to go out and enforce. The Codex Alimentarius Commission sets standards and gives guidelines, but it doesn't have enforcement authority. So what are these international bodies who would enforce? And that's where it's problematic, because you're really depending on sovereign countries who are members of these international organizations to step up and, you know, to resolve these issues. Now, it could be that countries can enter into treaties. We do have agreements like the SPS agreement, the TBT agreement, that are used in generally for safety and labeling, and they can result in cases that are brought in front of the World Trade Organization. But usually food fraud is so nimble and so difficult to clamp down on. So what I mean by that is oftentimes a fraudster, once you figure out who they are, they may pack up their tent and move somewhere else, change their name, change their identity. Sometimes they're big players. Sometimes they're involved in organized crime. We know that because I think there's a number of studies recently that have shown that. But sometimes they're smaller players as well. But my point is that it's really hard to freeze everything and to take the time to go through a tribunal at the WTO to bring a case. And who are you bringing the case? It's not a case where you can bring action against private players. You have to bring it against countries. And so there's really not a forum for enforcement on an international level. And that's why what we do in our report is we showcase the international strategies that can be used, you know, conventions and standards and contract conventions and private public platforms for cooperation and for co-regulation. And we use these as ways of building cooperation between countries, as well as giving specific suggestions to countries on ways that they can adopt and legal strategies that will work. There is no one silver bullet that's going to solve this problem. It has to be a series of steps. And if you don't mind my sort of segueing into what it really takes, quite frankly, is for a country, a jurisdiction, and it to become systems thinking. In other words, to become a real food systems thinker. We talk about this food system out there. I've never quite been able to figure out where the system is. But I do know that we need systems thinkers, people who are able to identify mutual goals and objectives and identify their resources and then think incrementally about how to solve problems. And that's where law can actually play a really important role by bringing together different parties and different stakeholders. So these are strategies, not necessarily tools. And that's where I think countries can need to engage with each other. So not one country can go out there and solve food fraud. We actually need countries to speak to each other, to work together.
You mentioned public-private partnerships. What does that look like? How does that help? How is that a strategy?
Well, it really is a strategy because it has to be. In other words, there is not, as I mentioned earlier, there's not a single government that can solve the problem of global food fraud. And so in many cases with these very complicated world supply lines, you have multinational companies, quite frankly, from manufacturers to distributors to retailers, who probably have more control over supply lines than do the governments because of necessity. I mean, the governments can't step in and intercede in supply lines in other countries. But multinationals in the private sector have that ability because they have a vested interest in supply lines, and they can do it all the time through contract, for example, through private standards and through creating expectations by contract that suppliers have to deliver authentic food, or it has to be certified by a reputable certifier that it is authentic. And you have a way of verifying that. So in other words, it's not something that I'm just proposing or we did in the report because we think that we're ideologically aligned that way, but because it has to be that way in order to really be to solve the problem. You have to have private and public working together, as well as the public stakeholders working together as well.
That, again, makes sense. And when we talked about public-private partnerships in our last podcast with Professor Tim Litton a bit too. And so I also want to ask, in the report, you talk some about the strategy of criminalization. Why is this an interesting or potentially positive approach?
Yeah, and I should mention too, with respect in sort of leading up to answering your question, you know, one of the frustrating things in dealing with food fraud is that oftentimes the stakeholders that I've spoken to, for example, who are major stakeholders, are also part of the problem. So, you know, for example, with food safety, everyone has a vested interest in wanting the food to be safe. Nobody wins with unsafe food. But there unfortunately are winners when it comes to food fraud. Those are winners who, by economic means, are able to make more money. And it's oftentimes, even in large organizations, you have upper management saying, we don't agree, we don't want to have fraud. And yet those in the middle or somewhere embedded in the organization, because of cost cut or because of cost pressures, will oftentimes give in, and they look the other way or don't give as much attention to a potential fraud problem. And so it's messier than just a normal run-of-the-mill food safety problem, where everybody really wants the food to be safe, because we all win when the food is safe. Nobody wins if it's not. Not so much with food fraud. But criminalization is I think, an interesting approach that we gave some attention to in the report. And it's really many of the activities that could be considered food fraud have been criminalized in national criminal laws. And, you know, I think we cited to the German criminal code, for example. Another provision in the report we cite to the Indian penal code. And so there's examples out there where I think this could work. What it really requires is that you have to have an understanding of how criminology works. And it's, you have to connect it to, you know, behavior. And this is something that most of us that are in the regulatory world in the government don't know a lot about. We're not seasoned criminologists. And so there's a lot of strategy that needs to go into thinking about this issue. And I think our report was intended to do that. But we certainly, I think the report makes clear that this is an area that certainly can be examined much more carefully. And there is some movement in this field. But connecting food vulnerability to criminology is something that I think needs to be explored a great deal more.
And we see that in your report. What, now that the report's been published, have you seen any effects? I know these are effects are hard to trace. Have you gotten any interesting responses to the report?
Yeah, I was actually pretty surprised. There's some major food companies who contacted me after the report, and I was heartened by it because they liked it. They felt like it was helpful to them, and they had the companies that contacted me were already thinking about this and working on it. I have found that some of this is personality driven, quite frankly, where food companies will hire in safety management who are sophisticated and they truly want to do what's best for the consumer as well as for the company and for society. And they're very interested in food fraud and dealing with it. And so, you know, we try to take advantage when we find these people emerging in leadership in food companies. Again, they cross the board from retailers to manufacturers. They also, these are companies who understand that they probably have food products that are in a space that are susceptible to fraud. And so they also are looking after their own interests, self-interest, making sure that they're not losing customers because somebody's underselling at a lower price a substitute food product that you know affects not only the consumer but also hurts their business as well. So there's a lot of reasons to talk to food companies. I think the because it's such a complicated problem, and food companies will rightfully think, gosh, this is a problem that's so big and so massive. Why are we expected to fix it? And so you do get some of that. And you and I have had this conversation many times that oftentimes the solutions are in small steps. And hopefully the report reflects that kind of an approach where there's lots of different things that people can do, including food companies who want to do well by doing good, can implement to make their supply lines certainly safer as well as more authentic for consumers.
And on that optimistic note, I will say thank you, Michael. This has been so interesting. And thank you to our audience for listening.
Can I mention one more thing?
Of course.
Sorry about that. So I recently at the Food and Drug Law Institute conference in Washington, D.C., I moderated a panel on litigation and food fraud. Now, that's a unique U.S. approach. And again, the complexities of using, and that's something we did not mention in the report, because it's not a tool that's used by other countries. Generally, that tool is not used by other countries like it is used in the United States. And that's, you know, class action and these major lawsuits that we see in the food labeling space, especially here in California, as well as other states. It's really hard to litigate in this field. One, because again, who are the defendants? Well, generally, they're overseas, and that's not easy. Secondly, it's expensive. You have to find testing facilities, and you have to be able to hire experts who understand the problems with to identify the problem with the food product itself, as well as the system that it's traded in. It's hard to collect, and it's, you know, once you get a judgment, how are you going to collect that judgment when it's a company from another country? So for this reason, I think it's really difficult. And it's something we spent quite a bit of time on talking about in the conference as well. And then last, I always leave this question with my students. Do we care? If you go into a sushi bar and you buy a tuna thinking it's tuna and it's really tilapia, what's your reaction? Do you care enough to not go there again, to complain to management, or you just eat what they give to you and you're happy with it because it tastes good and you feel like you're thinking, well, it's probably still healthy for me. And so there's that ultimate question as to, do consumers care? I think they do, but I live in my bubble. You care. Because we care, we do what we do. But I do think that consumers care, but that is the ultimate question. And then we just have to help consumers find remedies. And that's what this report's all about.
That's really interesting. I will put a link to the Food, Drug, and Law Institute to the conference. I think it's paywalled, but in case any of our listeners have a membership, they may want to listen to that. And we have done other podcasts on the role of class action litigation in food policy change, but I think we should do more on that in the future, because that as a strategy in this context is really interesting also. But thank you so much for this, and thank you to our audience for listening. I will put links in the show notes to all of the work we mentioned today, and you can reach either Professor Roberts or me, Diana Winters, through our emails, which are also linked through our show notes. Listen to us next month for another food law and policy conversation. Thank you, Professor Roberts.
Thank you.